是笑我一无所有。我要给你我的追求，还有我的自由，可你却总是笑我一无所有。
Rock and roll was always looked on with suspicion in communist countries as a symbol of rebellion, which may have accounted for its underground appeal in the Soviet Union and other Eastern European countries. But it came rather late to the Middle Kingdom, and yet in the years since, it has experienced a thriving underground scene. Jonathan Campbell, a Canadian drummer and writer, spent 10 years in China, and today he says Chinese rock and roll has emerged with the potential for a global audience. Mr. Campbell's book, Red Rock, The Long, Strange March of Chinese Rock and Roll, is published by Earnshaw, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here.
So when was rock introduced to China?
Well, actually, we just heard that song, which was the way Chinese rock was introduced to China, but it came in 1986, and Western pop only started to come in the wake of Chairman Mao's death in 1976 because the doors were sealed shut. So it only came in the late 70s, this pop music, and then slowly into the 80s, as more and more people were able to come into the country and go out of the country, they could bring the music with them.
Since most Chinese dialects also have tones, you to pronounce words correctly, you almost have to sing the words. How does that affect singing song lyrics?
Yeah, I feel like song lyrics are generally contextual enough that it's not a super huge deal to make sure that you enunciate the tones, because it would, of course, it would make it very difficult. But again, it's, you know, the rhythm of the language is something different, and so they just work at, they use the lyrics differently.
Who were the most influential early foreign rockers in China?
It's interesting because they're not all that necessarily rockin'. The guy we just heard, Sui Jian, who's the first Chinese rocker, he loved people like The Carpenters, Lionel Richie, Wham. But he also loved, you know, The Police. He also loved Public Enemy and Bob Dylan and all of the, you know, the greats you would associate with.
It's just Elvis, the Beatles.
Elvis, the Beatles, sure. But the thing is, because it came so late to China, what Chinese kids heard first was the more contemporary stuff that other young people from around the world brought in. And so when they went back to the Beatles, they kind of went, well, that's not that interesting. Mm-hmm. I like Bon Jovi.
They were getting it backward.
So. Exactly. I mean, but it just, because it just came.
How do you say rock and roll in Mandarin?
Yeah, the word is yaoguan, and that's the word I actually try and introduce into the English language through this book.
Is it important. A literal translation?
It's a literal translation. You yao your head when you nod, and you tell somebody to roll away by saying guan.
Is yaoguan all that different from what you might hear elsewhere? I mean, that song we just heard, I guess it could be translated into English. Although,
and in fact, it was by a Danish band called Michael Learns to Rock. It wasn't translated. They sort of took it and made it their own. But yeah, it's like that tune, that was a beginning and a very mellow beginning, obviously, not exactly the hard rock. There is a sort of, you know, harder element to that song and to that artist in particular.
And when it gets harder, did it remain relatively Western, or has it moved into a kind of a unique Chinese style?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the what makes yaoguan different from rock is more of a sort of conceptual thing, whereby the reasons behind why people got into the music, the things they were trying to do with music. You know, it was, you were talking about socialist and communist countries. I mean, the idea of producing art was something different than the way we see it. Certainly by the time rock came to China, rock was no longer this capital A art form that was supposed to change the world for us. But for them, when they heard it and they read about the 60s in the United States, they thought, wait a second, rock and roll can mean something to us because our country is experiencing a period of time when we need to figure things out. And this can be a way to help to do that.
But the government has continued to crack down on writers, on lawyers.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Ai Weiwei is under house arrest, the artist. Isn't rock and roll still seen as a possible vehicle for protest?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, related to what I was just talking about, the fact that art can mean something works both ways for the artist and for the authorities, right? So the authorities are worried because they know that art is an important element in the revolution.
So do they censor songs?
Well, so every song that ever any artist that wants to publish an album, to put out a record officially, they submit their lyrics to the Ministry of Culture, and the Ministry of Culture goes over them and decides whether or not they're up to snuff. Same goes for performers on, you know, major stages. So you submit your set list and your lyrics in advance, and as long as it passes muster, you're okay to perform.
And if in the middle of a performance you suddenly sing a lyric that nobody expected, you're in trouble?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it just depends. You know, Bjork thought she could get away with it a few years back, right before the Olympics. She said Tibet, Tibet, and people freaked out. And then after that, people were paying very close attention. It's sort of, you know, it's this Wild West type situation where everything's okay until it's not okay. So it's hard to know.
Well, Bjork wasn't arrested, but no. Does that mean she'll never be allowed to perform in China, at least not in the foreseeable future?
She will probably – nobody will probably want to take her on. That's for sure. I mean, it's more about – it's not that someone will say, no, she did that thing. It'll be like promoters will say, well, that was that incident and we don't want to, you know.
What would people – what would kids listening to – I'm assuming this is mostly still – the appeal is mostly for younger people. Mm-hmm. What were they listening to before – things opened up?
Well, so throughout, you know, especially in the Cultural Revolution, which started in the mid-60s when basically China reinvented what it was calling culture, there were really only a very few things. I mean, literally, you know, a handful of official performances that could be performed, dances, all this stuff, operas, model operas, they called them. And so they weren't, and they were, there was a few traditional songs out there, but again, it was a lot of the same canon that the Soviet kids would have been listening to.
In fact, the Chinese classical music was influenced by Soviet classical music.
Exactly. And again, it's only in the mid-late 70s when things are allowed to slowly come in, and even just Western classical music, for example.
Has rock and other contemporary music now crowded out traditional Chinese music?
I wouldn't say so. I think that what's interesting to me is the rock and roll kids who are turning to their traditional music. A lot of them are from ethnic minorities, because there's a lot of ethnic minorities in China. And so you have bands that incorporate folk elements with their background coming through as young kids in the late 90s. They like rock and roll and they like throat singing. So they sort of incorporate that.
But still sing in Mandarin rather than in the various local dialects?
So I would say that it's a good mix of all that, of all the languages of the ethnic minorities, but it's also a lot of English, frankly.
And Hong Kong, I'd assume, would be more Western than
exactly.
Other
I mean,
parts
Hong
of China.
Kong was basically, you know, Britain until, well, not until, you know, in 1997 when it went back to China, it had been living as a British, you know, part of the Commonwealth. And I don't actually touch on Hong Kong in this book because it was such a normal thing in Hong Kong. I mean, the Beatles came in the 60s to Hong Kong, right? So it wasn't a stranger to things like Western pop music.
Jonathan Campbell's book is Red Rock, The Long Strange March of Chinese Rock and Roll. How did you get involved in Chinese rock?
Well, I showed up to study Chinese, as many people have done since and before, in 2000. And I had sold my drums because you can't take those on a plane really very easily. And so I bought a guitar and I walked into a music store and I said, I'd like to learn guitar, but I play drums. And the guy working at the music store said, we need a drummer. And so that was basically week three that I was in China in 2000. So I was playing in bands. I was checking out music. And I very quickly started to – I joined the team of a local magazine, you know, writing about events that were coming up and bands that were playing and art of all kinds. So it just sort of snowballed. And suddenly I knew all the venues. And so people wanting to come into China talked to me because they knew that I knew what was going on. And so I started organizing tours for bands. And it just sort of snowballed from there, writing the whole time.
Did you have to deal with the government? The first Chinese rocker, the one we opened with,
yes,
when he came on the scene, did the government see him as a threat?
I would say nobody came out and said so, but he's had his experiences of being in and out of favor with the authorities for sure. I mean, he is a guy that you know, took on when in the late 80s after he had made this song, which was called Nothing to My Name, which spoke to a lot of people in a way that music hadn't before, on an emotional level. He went and covered a communist classic called Naniwan, which is about a battle in this muddy part of the country, and he did it with a rock band, and people freaked out and they, you know, banned him from the stage for a while through the
90s. Because I would say it's a kind of a sacrilege.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was, you know, this young kid that didn't realize what he was dealing with, although he did very much realize what he was dealing with.
What about the idea of a rock star? Isn't that strange in a communist society that for much of its history suppressed the notion of having a strong sense of individuality unless you were Mao Zedong?
Absolutely. I mean, the first word in that song we just heard is I have asked you endlessly is the first line of Nothing to My Name. I mean, just to suggest that you may have nothing in 1986 is crazy because we're all supposed to have everything we need and give that which we can, you know. So yeah, but at the same time, there were pop stars. You know, there were stars because the country was slowly opening up.
Well, 2 years after, 3 years after, 1989, we have Tiananmen Square.
That's right.
Did rock play a role in that?
Well, one person said in the wake of Tiananmen, or in the lead up to Tiananmen, he said, what we don't accomplish in the square, rock and roll will do, because that was the idea then. You know, again, the 60s in America,
people
the
80s thought
in
Bob
China.
Dylan was going to lead a revolution.
Right. Totally.
Then he became politically conservative.
There you go. So, but yeah, I mean, there were definitely people were listening to guys like Cui Jen. He played in the square in May. Before the tanks rolled in. What's interesting is what came out of it, which is the government actually opening up a lot of land, technically speaking, to allow people to express themselves, but only in so much as they didn't cross that line that you could see what happens when you cross that line.
So you were in bands.
Yeah.
Did the bands always understand what that line was?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear. And in fact, when you have Westerners coming in and observing, you know, whether they're journalists or musicians or whatever, and, you know, the word political gets thrown around. And the first thing every Chinese kid I've ever dealt with, played with or watched or worked with has said, we're not a political. We're not doing anything political. We're talking about our lives. Now, of course, in our sense, they are very much doing something political. Even in 2012, it's a huge decision to not join society, you know, the job, the wife, the apartment, the fridge, the car, the television, all this stuff. I mean, it's a very huge statement to be making, which is why I think still Yao Guan is still embodying that, you know, rock and roll spirit that we don't seem to have in the West anymore.
What is the lifestyle of Yao Gunners, as you call them?
Right. Well, these days, I mean, you have a lot of kids that are, you know, little emperors. We've heard the term because there are, you know, there's a single child policy that's only now the first generation of single children are marrying other single children and are allowed to have a second, right? So you've had these kids that have had a lot of attention poured on them. You know, it's a classic sort of contemporary China situation where there's been a lot of change and a lot of development and there's been a lot of money in the cities. And so a lot of kids do lead privileged lives, but a lot of Yao Guaners don't. I mean, they have enough to buy the guitar, which is a not unsubstantial amount of money, and the clothes and all that stuff. But they are choosing to forego, you know, the wealth of their fellow citizens.
Well, do they remain underground, or are we talking now about rock stations?
You're definitely not talking about rock stations. You have a DJ I talked to a couple of years ago said she had to sneak on music like the guy we just heard from. You know what I mean? So I don't know how you sneak that on the radio. What she said is we don't say who it was when we play it. So it is. And even music festivals that are all rock bands, which are happening all over the country, hundreds literally, they can't call themselves rock festivals because that word Yao Guan still holds that little dangerous.
Now, I've heard rock music, well, the Scandinavian performers generally sang in English.
Right.
I've heard rock sung in English from Japan, from Vietnam. What about China?
There's a lot of English, and, you know, the older guys will tell you that that's kind of a cop-out, that the kids aren't interested in really exploring the complexity of the Chinese language. But I think for a lot of kids, you know, they don't expect what one kid said was, we don't expect Germans to be playing Beethoven, right? They just play what they want to play. So they're just playing rock and roll, and the language of rock and roll is generally English. Now, there are lots of bands singing in Chinese, but it's something that the problem is when they sing in Chinglish, which is that combination of Chinese and English. And then especially if they're trying to be serious, the way it comes out when you read the lyrics sort of ruins that message a little.
Well, we have seen some movement from Asia into the wider world of rock.
Absolutely.
Are we likely to see that with Chinese rock as well?
I sure hope we do. I mean,
do you think it's uniquely different?
I think it's different enough to make people go, wait a second, rock and roll is more than just something we choose to listen to. These kids are living it. And a guy like Cui Jen, he's in his 25th year since his rock album debut, so he's eligible for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I mean, there's no reason that a guy who introduced rock and roll to a billion people shouldn't deserve to be alongside his peers. He happens to make great music as well. So, and I think once people sort of get past the idea that there is a thing called Chinese rock and roll, that it exists, because for a lot of people, China is this big black box that we can't figure anything out.
Well, so, how would we even learn about it? Through the internet?
Through the internet.
There's a lot of YouTube Chinese rock?
There's definitely. I mean, YouTube is not something that Chinese people can get to with ease in China. There's Chinese versions of it, but there are a lot of videos on YouTube. There's my book. There's my website, which I definitely have a lot of information out there on. And I think that, you know, in this kind of world we live in, people are interested in that so-called quote-unquote world music, right? Music from other places. And so I think that there's a lot of opportunities, I think.
Are there record companies in China, or are we seeing something similar to what we're seeing here, where record companies are disappearing? And
yeah, I mean, it's just like that, except that there was no long tradition that crumbled, whereas there was here. So in China, right, it's a very much like we make it up, we figure it out as we go. We had to deal with piracy from literally day one, and mass piracy. So we have ways of figuring out. And, you know, nobody's going to make $1 million playing Yaogun, but they are still selling the records.
Are you still in China?
I live in Toronto now. I've been back a few times since I left, which was 2 years ago. So I spent 10 years there, and I'm still in touch with a lot of people, and hopefully helping to bring a little bit of China into North America as well, musically.
Jonathan Campbell has written for The Globe and Mail, The Toronto Star, The Wire, South China Morning Post, and now he's written a book called Red Rock, The Long, Strange March of Chinese Rock and Roll. It is published by Earnshaw Books.
That's right.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's go out, rock and roll.